News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, coming to you each and every Sunday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and KMJ580.com. Hope that you had a very Merry Christmas with your family. If you're like me and you celebrate that holiday, one of my favorite days of the whole year for obvious reasons. If you're not one of those that celebrate that holiday, I hope that you had a nice time with your family too, and that you won't mind too much if we talk a little bit about Christmas today. Because if you're like me, and one of the first places you go in the Fresno Bee is to the letters to the editor, and you read through them, when you open your newspaper Christmas morning, you might have found this letter that is headlined, A Very Special Time. And it says, A Very Special Christmas I Will Always Remember. It started on December 18, 1944, when a Navy task force operating in the South Pacific became involved with an enemy it could not fight back against, a typhoon. My ship, a destroyer, along with two other destroyers, was capsized. After floating alone in just a life jacket for about 12 hours, and then on a broken-up life raft for another 3 days without any food or water, and in shark-infested water, I was rescued along with several shipmates. Christmas Eve is special, for we were carried on board the USS Solis, a large hospital ship anchored in Ulithi, and the nurses were singing Christmas carols. It still brings tears to my eyes. On Christmas Day, they fed us like royalty. They told us several shipmates had lived and were on another ship in the lagoon. They also told us two other destroyers were lost with very few survivors. So as you can see, Christmas is a very special time for me. I am thankful that I survived. I'll say thanks to a praying mother, but it saddens me deeply that I lost so many of my shipmates. Signed, Pat Doohan, Fresno. So if you read that letter like I did, I'm sure you were touched by it. And one of the first things I did was try to get a hold of Mr. Doohan, because I thought we ought to have him on this show and hear the rest of that story. So that is what we'll do today. Pat Doohan is our guest. He lives in Fresno now. He grew up in Madera. And Pat, before we get to all the details of your incredible story here, what kind of response have you gotten since this letter was printed in the paper on Christmas Day? Did you get a few phone calls at home?
Yes, I have received some phone calls, and in fact, one of the fellows that I received a phone call, he was in the typhoon on an oiler, a tanker. And he was quite interested and was anxious to get a hold, and he and I are going to get together for coffee next week. He lives in Clovis.
It is a small world, isn't it?
It is a very small world. It's very interesting when something's publicized, the phone calls you get and the letters you get and emails you get.
And you didn't write that to try to get any special attention. You wanted to share something that was special to you, and I think that resonates with everyone. But isn't it neat that when you share something like that, that is special to you, that it's special to some other people, too?
Brings back a lot of memories, especially, you know, as our generation were gradually leaving this country or leaving this earth, and those memories are something we never forget. And a lot of people, I cherish them, and a lot of people believe, well, we should pass them on.
Amen to that. And that's what this show is all about. It's about preserving those stories while you're still here to tell them. It's about honoring you for your service and hopefully inspiring some younger folks like myself to try to live up to that legacy that the Greatest Generation has given us. Well, thank you. And I'm going to be saying that a few more times by the time we're done today. Let's get started now as we look back through your life. One place that I like to begin with every guest, every veteran that we have on this show, December 7th, 1941. Where were you? What do you remember? And how did you find out that the United States was under attack?
I heard it broadcast on the radio. I was working for Shell Oil, and of course Sunday I was day off. And I heard it, and I was shocked like everybody else was. And being wanting to get in and do something, I spent that night, I had a nice little Ford convertible, but I spent the night hauling coffee out to these, well, I think every Santa Fe bridge was had men out there guarding them, because we didn't know what was going to happen. So I spent all night carrying coffee out to those different men working.
Well, that kind of reminds me of a story one of the Pearl Harbor survivors I've had on the show told me. He was down in Long Beach, and that night after they heard the news, he went out to the pier at Long Beach with a rifle. He was ready to shoot the Japanese if they came ashore. Sounds like you were doing pretty much the same thing in the valley here.
In fact, I was going to enlist the next day, But Shell Oil Company, within a few days, they put a bulletin out that if you were an employee of Shell so long, your job was preserved if you enlisted or went in the service, and your wife would get half. They would make up the difference between your pay with them and the service pay up to half of what they're making. Of course, I wasn't married, but they paid my service insurance and guaranteed my job.
So how long was it until Uncle Sam did get a hold of you?
Well, the day that time was up was in 42, the early part of 42, and I was down at the Navy enlistment office that day.
You were ready to go?
I was ready to go.
And I bet most of the folks in Madera and all around here kind of had that same mentality. Was that your recollection?
Yes. In fact, three of my real close buddies, we all went down and enlisted together. And we went through boot camp, and it was a funny thing. Early in the war like that, they were losing so many ships. I went to boot camp through San Diego. I went 21 days through boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
Just enough to get your shots and march. And out of the company, there was a few of us got school. I was lucky I got sonar or sound school. So I was in school a little bit longer before I got my assignment.
Now, how did that happen? Is that something that you volunteered for, or did they test you and figure out this guy's got good ears?
No, they noticed on my record that I'd worked for the oil company on the geophysical crews, and that had something to do with, you know, sound echoing and things like that. So they did that. So that's how I got into that part.
And at this point, you're almost 20 years old. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Still a pretty young man.
Right.
A lot of life ahead of
you. Right.
Did you have any idea what kind of things you were going to face? When you thought about this is what war is going to be like and this is the adventure I'm going to have in the Navy, was what actually happened anything like what you thought it was going to be?
Well, in a way, my father was in the Navy in World War One, and by the way, one of my sons made two trips to Vietnam, too. But anyway...
In the Navy?
In the Navy, yeah. And his son was in the Navy. Anyway, talking to the ones, I knew that we were up against a tough battle, and we were losing ships, and, of course, being very patriotic, I was going to get there, because I remember every Armistice Day, as we called it in those days,
mm-hmm.
and Memorial Day, my dad used to put his Navy uniform on and walk in the parade in Madera.
How about that?
Mm-hmm.
So November 11th's been a special day for you for
right.
a long time. So you get through boot camp, and they moved you through there pretty fast, which I think would probably be a good thing, right?
Right.
The shorter
just
the boot camp, the better?
Just enough to get your shots. That's about it. I didn't have the long grind that most six-week boot camps do.
And they put you on a destroyer right away?
No, I went to school. Sound school.
Oh, that's right.
Yes. I was one of the few out of the company. The rest of them went right to the fleet, but I was one of the few that went to sound school and got my my ratings there.
Where did they send you for that?
San Diego. I stayed right in San Diego.
It's not a bad place to be.
Not a bad place to be at all.
I've heard a lot of places people were sent during the war, and I don't think any of them are quite as nice as San Diego.
A real interesting thing I might mention, when I went on board our rate, they gave us a quartermaster badges, you know, on your rating badge. They didn't have soundman badges or sonar badges in those days. And boy, the quartermasters, they were really hot when we'd show up with those. Said, you guys, that's a left arm rate. That's not a right arm rate, if, you know, people would know what that means. But anyway, when we'd show up with that kind of rate, well, oh boy, they would really scream. Pretty soon they came out with a headphone crow that we change all of our ratings.
After all the complaints from
right.
the quartermasters. You're a quasi-quartermaster.
Right.
So you get through sonar school, and was that entertaining for you? Was that some new things? I imagine there wasn't a whole lot of sonar equipment out in Madera growing up.
No, there wasn't any out there. It was new, it was interesting, and you go through the sound operating school, then you go to the material or tech school, and both of them, they put you through. And the first class petty officer that ran the tech school, he said, I'm going to take you guys, you're going to all the way through in 4 weeks and a couple other weeks. And he said, I don't want to see any of you in here trying to crash on Friday night because you're going to get a test every Saturday morning. So all of you go out and get drunk on Friday night so you'll be relaxed and ready for the test Saturday morning.
Not too often you get that kind of advice, is
no.
it?
No. Hey, that's the old Navy.
did you follow that advice?
I'm not talking.
We don't want to play into any Irish stereotypes.
Right.
Here.
Sure.
Nice brogue you have there. Well, how long was it before they actually said, okay, here's your destroyer, hop aboard?
On March of 42.
That's not a whole lot of time?
No, March 43, yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I had put in for new construction. I was sent to San Francisco, up there a few days, and got my orders. The ship had been over, got some new radar and sound equipment on it. Went out the dock, and here it was. It looked like it was the oldest ship in the fleet. It was an old destroyer, the first of the two stacked destroyers. It was commissioned in 1935.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the crew on there were what we call Asiatics. They had been on, some of them had been on the ship since 1939.
Mm-hmm.
And while, if you went to on Liberty with them, you're lucky the shore patrol didn't bring you back. But they were good sailors, excellent sailors and good men.
And this was the USS Hull?
USS Hull, DD-350.
And you got on right in time to head to for an Alaskan cruise, huh?
Head up the Aleutians.
Burr.
And boy, when we went down to San Pedro, and we didn't know where we were. They'd been all through Guadalcanal and those operations. But when they started hauling that cold weather gear on, we said, oh, boy, we know where we're going. So when we hit ADAC, that was so cold that night up there, and we did patrol across the channel. And, we thought we were going to freeze.
Now, were you properly prepared for that? Did you have the right kind of clothing and equipment?
Yes, they gave us the right kind of clothing.
Well, thank the Lord for that. I'll tell you what, we need to catch our first commercial break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about that typhoon. Yeah, you know, oftentimes on this program, I get so caught up in the early stages of a veteran service that we get to the end of the program and there's just not enough time to discuss those real intense moments. I'm not going to make that mistake today. So when we come back with Pat Doohan, we'll talk about that horrific typhoon of late 1944, the great Christmas memories that came after he was rescued, and we'll make sure we save plenty of time for that. Then fill in the blanks when we're done with that. How's that sound? Sound like a plan to you? I think that's going to work. We'll be right back with more Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Recognize that as Anchors Away, performed there by the Sounds of Freedom Band, a local band made up of volunteers aged 15 to 90, if you can believe that. We appreciate the music that they allow us to use week in, week out here, and we play Anchors Away today because it's a Navy veteran of World War II, Fresno's Pat Doohan, who joins us today. Pat is the second generation of four consecutive generations of Navy men, all who are in the same rank.
Right.
And at the same rate, yeah. And your grandson is the most recent to earn second class petty officer?
Correct.
And
he's been out for a number of years. I mean, he's back in civilian life now. But
he could have gotten out earlier, and he is having none of it if he couldn't make the same rating.
Right, that is correct.
Well, good for him, and good for you, and thank you to your whole family for serving our country the way you have. Now, I know with all the battle stars that the USS Hull earned and all of those battles that you were there for, there's going to be plenty for us to talk about, but I want to skip ahead to, as you called it in your letter to the Fresno Bee on Christmas Day, an enemy you could not fight back against. Let's talk about the typhoon and make sure we cover all of this with the time that we've been given today. Now, this is December 1944. And I guess just after the middle of the month, it's about the same time that the guys in Europe are dealing with the Battle of the Bulge. You guys are dealing with weather that you've never seen anything like it before. What was the first hint you got that something was amiss?
Well, the weather started getting bad. We'd been at the States for a yard overhaul, and we stopped at Ulithi. The fleet had made one operation on the Philippines when MacArthur landed. And then we were taking out a bunch of oilers to refuel the fleet and then join the fleet. So we got out, we started refueling, and it started getting impossible to refuel. And a lot of those ships were getting real low on fuel. And the weather was getting worse and worse. And the 17th, why, they were breaking fuel lines and everything else. So they said, we just can't do it anymore. And like as a typhoon, one of the ships was out of oil, just completely out. So that's when we got into the weather was just getting bad. And the 17th, why, it was, the waves were just unbelievable.
I mean, were you topside for any of this?
I was on the bridge most of the time.
Uh-huh.
And, of course, the waves were breaking clear over the top of the bridge. We were taking, the waves were estimated at 65 to 100 feet high.
Ooh.
And when you're down that trough, you're looking up the top of the waves. And the wind was peaking up to putting her 200 knots. And it was just breaking these ships up. And we were taking 50 and 60-degree rolls. And we took a lot of 70-degree rolls. And stuff was being broken off the ship. And the night before we went down, it was pure havoc on the bridge. We picked up a new captain, and it was a disaster. The Kane Mutiny is something people were wondering if it was written about our ship, because we tried to get the exec to take over. It was so bad up there. But anyway, we were taking rolls 70 degrees, taking water, and we took one 80-degree roll and took water down one of our stacks and put the fires out in the forward fire room.
And for folks at home who don't understand the lingo there, if you have a 90-degree roll, then you are perpendicular to the water.
Yeah.
And your stack is parallel to the water. If an 80-degree roll, you're almost to that tipping point.
Right.
That's pretty severe.
Well, what happened, we'd take a roll like that, and then a wave underneath would push us back up.
Uh-huh.
And we knew we lost some men overboard during the night over the fantail. And I did probably a very stupid thing, or maybe it saved my life. But in the middle of the morning, I'd been on the bridge all night, and of course we didn't have any food or water or anything up there, or coffee, which is something you can't do without, but we had to do without because it's impossible to make coffee in the galley. I said, I'm going to go back and get some sack time. So being an open deck destroyer, one of the old ones, we had an open deck to the after part of the ship. Well, the ship was on a roll, and I made a dash, and I could have easily been washed overboard, but I grabbed a hold of a couple torpedoes. One of the torpedo tubes made my way into the after deck house. Then I went down, got in my sack, and I got immediately thrown out when the ship rolled. So I went up on topside in what we call the after deck house and was there with about 20 or 30 of my shipmates in that little compartment.
What did the mood seem to be on the ship? Did you see fear in people's eyes?
Yes, fear and uncertainty. And I think on the bridge that night, it was uncertainty, and it was a fact that we had somebody that didn't know what they were doing, and the older men, they say, hey, we're in a bad place, and when the barometer drops like it did, why, the old sailors that were been in the Orient, they knew what we were in for. And when you're taking water and you're wanting to jettison like the whale boat on the side, and the captain wouldn't let you, and it was finally broken away and went over the side anyway. And one of the chiefs wanted everybody to put on their life jackets. And you have the captain say, what are you doing, trying to scare my crew? Why, you know.
No, trying to save their lives.
Uncertainty. And so it was kind of havoc up there on the bridge that night. But when I got in that after deck house, why, the guys were either praying or crying or cussing.
Yeah, that pretty much runs the gamut.
Right.
Covers it all. Now, how long did this go on?
Well, it went on. I got up in the after deck house, in that after part of the ship. We went over around noon. And when the ship would roll, one of the hatches was broken off and the water had come in. And then when it straightened up and go out. And when it finally went over, I was fortunate. I had a hold of the handle on one of the hatches. And there was an air vent above. Well, put my foot in that air vent and hold of that handle, but I couldn't get the hatch open. Here, water was coming up. Well, the latches on the hatch, or we call them dogs, they're kind of big handles. Well, a lot of my shipmates had a hold of those. And There's no way. I had to kick their hands off. That still bugs me today, because I had to kick their hands off. They dropped down in the water in order to get that hatch open. I don't know how many of those survived. I mean, it just...
Even though none of them could have gotten out unless you did that,
none of them, and
you don't know if they made it or not.
I don't know. I know some of them made it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got the hatch open, it came back on my back, and several scooted out and didn't come back and pull it off of me. Finally, one fella did, and I was meaty, and I had no life jacket.
So you were almost trapped in there by the hatch itself.
Right. And I had no life jacket. My life jacket was on the bridge. I left it up there all night. And it had a flashlight and a whistle on it, which we were issued. And so when I came out of there...
Hold on, I don't want to get in the way of... And I know you've got this memorized up here, but I just want to dwell on this for a second. So you pull the hatch open, but the pressure of the water pins you. The hatch has you pinned. You can't move, right?
Can't move.
What is going through your mind at that moment?
Am I going to make it? Yet, I never gave up hope. That's something that I just had. I never gave up hope. By then, I'd come back to the States one time. One time we came in for a short visit. I got married. I married the girl I was going with before the war, Fresno girl. And she was pregnant when we left after our yard overhaul, which 13 other wives were that I knew of. Only three of us came back. Anyway, I had hope. I knew that I just couldn't give up.
You had a wife and a baby you hadn't met.
Yeah, uh-huh. Expecting a baby.
Uh-huh.
But, there's one thing that I think helps. I had a lot of faith from above, plus the fact I was a swimmer.
Mm-hmm.
And water itself doesn't bother me. The elements, but the water itself.
Did it seem like an eternity before someone came and pulled that hatch off you?
It seemed like an eternity. And when I came out of there, like I said, I didn't have a life jacket. But there was one spare life jacket tied to a gun. And somebody up there put it there for me, and I slipped it on. And I was immediately washed up midships, then washed clear of the ship.
Now, when you say somebody put it there, do you mean one of the fellow sailors put it there?
Somebody up above put it there.
It was divine intervention.
Right.
Was there any reason for it to be there?
They usually had several extra life jackets tied to guns around there, but why that one was there at that one spot.
So you come through the hatch.
I came out the hatch, and the ship was on its side at that time.
Uh-huh.
And
can you see? What can you see? Can you see anything?
You see the whole side of the ship all the way up to the... It was over on its side, and I got washed up midships. And then another wave. Then about that time, one of my shipmates, one of those big old life jackets, had him jammed against the side of the ship, and we couldn't get to him to pull it off. And the last thing I remember, he raised his fist in the air and yelled, "Fight on!" He was a Pearl Harbor survivor, and he was one of the greatest guys on ship, but his favorite words was, "Fight on!" And that's the last I saw him.
Hmm.
We couldn't break him loose.
But you were able to get that life jacket on.
I totally, yes.
And then how did you get off the ship, or did the ship take care of that for you?
The ship took care of that. I was washed free of the ship. And I was out there, and there was a lot of sailors in the water, and there was life jackets or life rafts around. And I grabbed a hold of one big life raft, but it was tied to another life raft. And these big, huge life rafts, when they would bang together, I saw some of my shipmates' heads pop open like popcorn.
Ugh.
And I let go immediately. And then a wave came up between me, and I didn't see anybody from then on. I did feel the ship going down on my body. I mean, you could just feel when it hit the depth,
uh-huh.
Why you could feel, feel exploding. And
Did it disappear from your view pretty quickly?
Yes, it went down. And pretty soon all of a sudden, I felt like I was being sucked down deep and deep. And being in the middle of a task force, I didn't, and you couldn't see. The rain was so fierce, it was just cutting your face if you looked into it. And all I could think of, I'm being drawn into the propellers of another big ship going by. And you could just think, you're just drawn deeper and deeper down at the depths, and there's no way of stopping it. And you fear that. and then all of a sudden you're shot to the surface. Well, after that happened twice, I realized I was going up a wave and one of the tops, the crest of the waves was breaking over me and shoving me down.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, I'd double up when that would happen, it would hurt my ears, but it only happened a couple more times.
That's not the kind of body surfing that you dream about doing.
No.
Well, we're going to talk more about this, and remember, this is just from the perspective of the USS Hull, but there were other ships that went down that day, and Pat Doohan knows as much about that as just about anyone that you can find. We'll have more with Pat Doohan, World War II veteran, Navy veteran, and survivor of the sinking of the USS Hull in that typhoon in December of 1944. This is Hometown Heroes today on News Talk 580 KMJ. Remember that song? Our guest today, Pat Doohan, sure does. That's Dream from the Pied Pipers way back when, talking about memories, and there are plenty of memories to discuss today, including memories of that song. I understand that was one of your favorites in the Navy band after you got done with the service?
Well, I played in a Navy dance band, kind of. A bunch of us put things together in San Francisco, and we played around up there until I got out of the Navy.
And you're
good,
still
good duty.
You're still playing the trumpet today.
Yes, I play taps up at Madera. I'm the bugler for the VFW up there when we have a great VFW honor guard, and we feel the whole ball of wax, the seven rifles and the honor guard and the color guard.
Well, you are still serving, and I'm sure that all your fellow veterans appreciate that, and I know, as having been through a funeral recently, what it meant to my family when we had a veteran come and play a beautiful taps. I know that makes a difference for those families grieving, and hats off to you for continuing to do that.
Thank you.
Let's get back now from dreams to the greatest nightmare that you ever lived through in December of 1944. The Pacific Fleet, the U.S. Third Fleet, devastated by this awful typhoon, which has been known at different times as Typhoon Cobra, or Halsey's Typhoon was the famous name of a few books written about it. You've even been on a History Channel special, The Wrath of God, Halsey's Typhoon, Peril on the Sea. Now, when we left off, you had been washed overboard. And this isn't, we think about the movie Titanic or something like this, and you see the people calmly floating and watching all the devastation around them. You're still in the middle of a typhoon, and the rain is cutting into your face. So what is going through your mind at the time? What are you trying to do?
Well, trying to survive. The typhoon hadn't hit its peak until we'd been in the water for about an hour or so. And so we're right in the middle of it. And after I got away from that life raft that we're banging together, why, I was alone. And pretty soon the storm started a little bit subsiding, and it was getting darker, and here I was, can you imagine being out in the middle of South Pacific in just a life jacket, all alone, and getting dark?
No, thank you. And then there's those things called sharks.
Sharks and barracuda that you worry about. Well, the storm had subsided, and I was alone, and I didn't see anybody. And all of a sudden, something hit me in the back of the neck. And I was terrified. I thought, I'm going to be hit by a shark. Well, I reached back and grabbed it. It was dark then. I reached back and grabbed it, and it was a broom from the wreckage. And it was put there for a reason. Hours floating right there, why, your legs get pretty numb. So I was able to hold the broom between my hands and rest my feet on the shoulders of that broom and raise them up. So the broom was there for a reason.
sent to you by the same person who left the life raft with the gun.
Right.
The man upstairs.
Man upstairs. And I continued floating, and I saw a big searchlight. I said, oh, boy, somebody knows the ship went down. And I saw that searchlight going back and forth, and pretty soon I must have been in a fast current, because pretty soon I was over the horizon, and I didn't see it anymore. Later on, I found out it was a Tabor. It was also pretty near broken up DE that picked up a good number of my shipmates and other off of the other ship, too.
And that was the time at which the Taborer was picking people up?
Yes. Their antenna was broken off, their mast was broken off, so when they were getting ready to repair it, they saw this little light, and they thought a man was washed overboard. So they finally maneuvered and picked him up, and he said the hull went down. That was at 10 o'clock at night. That was the first time anybody ever knew any ship went down. And so they immediately started looking for other survivors, and they heard some of the whistles, and they started picking them up, and the next day Halsey ordered them to rejoin the fleet. But the good old captain, young captain, he disobeyed Halsey's order three times, and he picked up 56 men.
And thank the Lord he did.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if Halsey said that. But
a little later on, I was drifting, and it was dark. Now, I saw this little light, little bitty light, like a flashlight. So we were issued one cell flashlights and a whistle to put on our life jacket, but since my life jacket was on the bridge and I had a spare one, I didn't have it. So I yelled, and they yelled, who is it? And I told them, and I made my way over to it, and they pulled me in. It was some of my shipmates on one of these big rafts with the bottom pretty near broken out of it. But I got in it with them, and I felt good about that.
But I meant that wasn't what you were hoping for when you heard someone else's voice.
No. But
that's kind of like, wow, I'm getting rescued. Oh, I'm still stuck in the ocean.
Yeah, and we were stuck there. The next morning at daylight, the first thing we saw was 12 and 14-foot sharks, dorsal fins, circling us.
Well, how many of them would you say?
I would say there was from 3 to 4, and at different times there was more, and they would just keep circling us. And every once in a while, they'd make a pass at us, you know, turn over, and they could have easily gone underneath that raft and got our legs, but they didn't. They just were biding their time, I believe.
And how many of you were there on the raft?
12.
Are you able to talk to each other at this point? And
we could talk to each other. Two of them drank salt water and died from exposure, and we let them drift away. And
that couldn't have been easy.
No, that didn't. We, you know, your shipmates, why? You say something or say a prayer and let them go, and you know they're going to be gone. And we drifted several days, and some of the guys were going to go a little bit nuts at various times, hallucinating. And I think the last night out, pretty near everybody was in that frame of mind. One fellow went outside the raft, and the shark tore his arm up, and we got him back in. And another time, the second night out, on the horizon, one of the there's something over there. About that time, we'd been on some Japanese islands. We picked up this odor. We said, we're either floating into a close to Japanese island, there's a submarine surface charging its batteries. And later on, we determined it was probably a submarine. So we said, be quiet. So we did, but then nothing happened till the next day. The last day out, one of the fellas said, there's a bunch of ships on the horizon over there, and he pointed over there. He said, oh, you're nuts like everybody else. Well, we rubbed the salt out of our eyes, and sure enough, we saw some ships over on the horizon, just the stacks and the smoke. And about that time, two carrier airplanes came over, circling, you know, watching for submarines ahead of the fleet. And they passed over us, but, you know, they were so high up, a man looks like a little thumbnail in the ocean. But pretty soon they made a circle, and they came right down at water links, and they wiggled their wings, and we knew we'd been spotted.
They waved at you.
They waved at us, and pretty soon a big cloud of smoke went up from this fleet over there, and we knew a destroyer had lit off its boilers, and being some destroyer men, you know, when you see that big cloud of black smoke, you know something's coming. Well, a big, beautiful USS Brown pulled up alongside of us, and they threw us a line. And when they threw us a line, started pulling over to us, the sharks went into a frenzy, and they had to break out guns and just start firing to keep the sharks from, away from us. And so they got us up. They helped us up the rope ladder, and we got on deck. And of course, we're macho men, you know. Nothing wrong with us. We don't need two guys on each side of us. Let go of me. Well, they let go of me. I hit the deck immediately. I needed some help.
Well, you had, how long had you been in the water now?
Three and a half days, yeah.
Holy cow.
With no food or water. See, that the water was a bad thing. Food you can do without, but water you can't. So they took us in. The first thing they did was give us a shot of whiskey, which burned all the way down.
I imagine.
And then they gave us sips of water. I went to the Browns' first reunion a number of years ago. And the guy that gave me that sip of water wanted to have a picture taken with me, give him that sip of water. So then they immediately, they were getting low on supplies, but they broke out their best the next day, and they gave us some food, and each guy gave up a sack for us. A little bit later on, they picked up the only six survivors from the Monahan.
Mm-hmm.
They were 20 minutes later, they picked those guys up. They were a good bunch of guys.
And so by this time, you've realized our ship's gone, the Monahan's gone, the Spence is gone.
We didn't know about the Spence.
Okay.
We didn't, In fact, each man gave us a sack, and the fellow whose sack I'm in, he gave up. I'm still good friends with him.
How about that?
He lives in Sacramento. We visit once in a while. But anyway, they took us into Ulithi and took us over to the Solus, one of these big hospital ships painted white with a red cross on the side of us. And like I say in the letter, Christmas Eve, we were carried on board the Solus and stretchers, and the nurses were singing Christmas carols. I'll never forget that.
I can imagine why that is a Christmas memory that stays with you forever. At what point did it occur to you, almost 800 men died in this typhoon, and somehow I survived? And what did you make of that? Why do you think you are one of the ones that got to come home?
There's a reason. I'm still looking for it. There's a number of reasons, I guess. I mean, I have had a good family, I've had a good life, have a good wife, and a lot of good friends, although at our age we're losing a lot of them. Just like my shipmates, and being the reunion coordinator, we had to close it down after 22 years. But there's a reason, and I don't know.
You've been trying to figure the reason out?
I've tried to figure it out, and it saddened me to know that I lost so many shipmates. Some of them were very close to me. And on a ship like an old destroyer, except for the new fellows, we had just taken on a bunch of new fellows in Seattle, which we didn't get to know. But most of us had served several years together, and we're all very, very close, which makes it kind of rough when you're that close to a group and you've served and done so many things together to lose them. Out of the total, there was 92 survivors off the three ships.
And that's out of almost 900 men total.
So we say we got the most. We got 62. The Spence had 90, had 24, and the Monahan had 6.
Mm-hmm.
And I have the deck logs and everything to substantiate all the survivors and who they are, and I've been in contact with a lot of them, so we know them.
And that's been really neat for you, I know. I'll tell you what, we need to catch our final commercial break. But when we come back, we'll tie up the loose ends to this incredible typhoon story and talk about some of the things that you've been doing since. Pat Doohan of Fresno, our guest today, will be right back with more Hometown Heroes next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, coming down the home stretch. Just a few minutes left with Pat Doohan of Fresno, a survivor of the typhoon in the South Pacific in late December 1944. You heard him talk about floating for 3 days in shark-infested waters, but finally that glorious rescue by the USS Brown He would later find out he was one of 62 from the USS Hull who survived that typhoon, one of just 92 men off the three ships, the three destroyers that went down that day, to live. And it's a good thing he did. He was able to come home and see his wife again, be there for the birth of his son, two more children born later that never would have been here if he had not survived that typhoon. So, Pat, I know we just have a few minutes left here, but what was that like when you got to see your lovely bride again? Because I'm sure there was plenty of time floating out there in the Pacific that you thought, I'm not seeing anybody ever again except the good Lord.
Well, I landed in San Pedro, and I was anxious to get home, and I knew I had duty to work out the survivors and those mails at the Fleet Post Office in San Francisco. And when I hit the base at San Pedro, they said, well, get you on a plane to fly to San Francisco. Well, that went on for about a day and a half. Finally, I said, why don't you give me delayed orders and I can stop in Fresno and see my wife and pick up my car? Well, I had got hold of a good officer, and he said, here's your orders, get going. So I just got to see my wife, and of course, she didn't know the ship went down until a month later after it had gone down. I mean, those days, word was not out.
Mm-hmm.
And when I hit we hit San Pedro, why, there's a message there from the Fleet Post Office wondering where I was because the mail was stacking up. So I stopped, and they gave me a couple of days to visit my wife in Fresno, and I headed on to San Francisco and stayed up there and worked out the ship's mail, which sometimes is very trying because when you have to go through, you look at the mail, some of it you forward, but you look at a lot of it. The biggest part of it, you have to return to sender.
And that is a signal that is
something here, you know, this is his wife, and several of them had just gotten married in Seattle, or so you've got to send it on or back to their folks and things like that. So it's a little bit of trying sometimes when you have to do that, but it's one of those things you just end up doing because that's part of your job.
Yeah, that's just the way it is. I believe you mentioned a little earlier that when you left, you were back and got married, there were 13?
When we came back to the States for our yard overhaul in Seattle, which our ship was in real bad shape after being so much, when we left to go home, there were 13 of our wives pregnant. We're kind of a prolific bunch of guys, I guess.
I suppose.
We had not to see for so long. But out of the 13, three of us survived.
Hmm.
And I have talked and seen some of the children of those that were lost. And it's quite touching, and they're quite interesting to know what went on. And it was very, very touching to have them come up and just talk to you.
Well, what a great service that is to provide for them, to give them a taste of what their fathers were like, the fathers that they never knew. That's
especially
incredible.
Some of them that you knew very, very well.
I can only imagine. That's tremendous. And I know that you've been very active. You said you had to cut off the reunions because the group isn't big enough anymore. But almost 25 years ago, you started a reunion?
Yes, we started a reunion 26 years ago. And we had we always had some pretty good crowds because a lot of the fellows got transferred before the ship went down. And, of course, they were a bunch of the old fellows that had been on the ship at Pearl Harbor. And so we always had a good crew. But I got a kick. I told some of them, I said, you know, in our early reunions, we couldn't buy enough booze for you. But our last reunion, we couldn't buy enough Diet 7-Up and caffeine-free Coke or bottled water. But you know, they gradually diminished, and it got down. So our last few reunions, we were down to maybe 10 or 12 shipmates. Of course, we had about 50 people show up, but they were, you know, family.
Sure.
But I told the fellas, being the coordinator with one of that, I said, you know, before we get down where there's only one or two of us, of course, I expected to survive. That's where I said one or two of us.
Well, you do have a track record.
Yeah,
here.
Right. I said, maybe we better close it down. It was very, very hard because we'd become very close, like a family. In fact, our wives that attended, you know, a reunion every year for 22 years, you know, you get pretty close.
I would think
it
so.
It was a hard thing to do, but we all realized it had to do it. And they said, what are we going to do with the money that's left? Well, there's an organization called Tin Can Sailors. So they said, let's give it to them.
What
so
a nice
they keep up museum destroyers and things like that.
Well, that couldn't have been put to any better use, I'm sure of that. Well, speaking of, it's hard to do some things sometimes, but you have to. We have to close this program down because we're out of time. But, Pat, it's been a tremendous pleasure. Thank you for your service to our country then and what you continue to do now.
Well, thank you for letting me have the opportunity to express or tell a little bit about history that went on.
Maybe we'll do it again sometime. Pat Doohan of Fresno, our guest today. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.